podcast with Dr. Daniel Amen, who is like, you know, the world's foremost brain authority. And he spoke on a podcast about AI and the problems that he sees with it, and that we must be careful not to excessively use it.
Well, on that note, Sheila Lowe, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you for having me.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
Join me every Sunday night at 8 p.m. for Dark Star Dead and Music, the best in Grateful Dead music and beyond. This is your host, Arnella Barbara, Dark Star Girl at KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Esti Chandler. Last month, legal experts from an independent United Nations commission declared that Israel has committed genocide in the Gaza Strip, concluding, quote, "It is clear that there is an intent to destroy the Palestinians in Gaza through acts that meet the criteria set forth in the Genocide Convention," end quote. Shortly thereafter, the largest convoy in history set off to cross the Mediterranean on a mission to establish a humanitarian corridor to reach and deliver aid to the starving people of Gaza. Los Angeles native David Adler was a participant in that mission undertaken by a fleet of vessels known internationally as the Global Samud Flotilla. As Adler wrote at The Guardian, quote, "Hundreds of participants from more than 40 national delegations united by their shared conviction that something must be done to halt the destruction of Gaza, and that if the governments refuse to do it, then ordinary people will," end quote. As Adler also points out, while the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly adopted Resolution ES-1024 over a year ago, establishing the obligations of all member states to take immediate action to defend the fundamental rights of the Palestinian people, the very member states that represent us instead choose to continue to arm, aid, and abet the State of Israel in its expanding campaign of destruction, eviction, and annexation of the occupied Palestinian territories. And that, Adler wrote, quote, "is why so many millions of ordinary people are taking to the streets from New York to London and beyond to exhort their representatives to listen to the conscience of their constituents and respond to Gaza's humanitarian crisis with the urgency it requires," end quote. I am enormously grateful to have a self-described lifelong member of the KPFK community and now freed flotilla participant David Adler with us today to discuss his experience participating in the Global Samud Flotilla. David Adler is a political economist from Los Angeles, California. He currently serves as the co-general coordinator of Progressive International. Previously, David was a policy director for Yanis Varoufakis and international advisor to U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders. David is a Fulbright at the Colegio de Mexico, a Rhodes Scholar at the University of Oxford, and a Policy Leader Fellow at the European University Institute. It is my great pleasure to welcome David Adler to Middle East in Focus.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me. And I want to reiterate my lifelong support, commitment, and fandom for KPFK, which has buoyed me from my childhood to the present day.
Oh, thank you so much for that, David. Our community is very important, and we feel that this station belongs to the community. Let's jump right in here. The global Samud Flotilla that you were part of was unprecedented, a fleet of 40 boats larger than the sum of all previous missions. In the past, Israel has sometimes shrugged off flotillas as silly photo opportunities, and in other cases claimed that they represent an imminent threat to Israeli national security and violently attacked participants. Can you tell us about the unprecedented direct action that you engaged in, the numbers of quote-unquote ordinary people involved, their backgrounds, how you all organized, and how you prepared yourselves for the eventual encounter with the Israeli Navy, especially following the Israeli state officials insinuating that the flotilla had links to organized terror and threatens to stop your mission, quote, by any means necessary, unquote, in obvious violation of international humanitarian law?
There were many aspects of this particular mission that made it historically unique and inspiring for me personally to participate as one of 450 delegates from 45 countries around the world, a kind of United Nations in miniature, we might say. One aspect that made it really particular was its timing. It is not a coincidence that the largest convoy of humanitarian vessels coincided with this recognition of the genocide by the United Nations and coincided with a really large-scale mobilization of peoples across the world, from Malaysia to South Africa to Colombia and here, right here in the United States, to Los Angeles, for example, people speaking out about the 21st century's greatest humanitarian catastrophe, of course, you know, financed, supported diplomatically and militarily by the United States government. So I think that every one of us who were part of that mission arriving at that time felt not only a certain personal moral conviction about the need to stand up for the principles or values of humanity and decency in the face of such cruelty and barbarism in the course of the bombing campaigns over Gaza, but also a sense of responsibility to represent the communities that we're from. I know now, as I knew then getting on the boats, that I was not there alone as just, you know, a Jewish kid from the San Fernando Valley. I was there hopefully representing or delegated from a community of concerned citizens, many of whom had spent the past 2 years in a kind of well of desolation or desperation or impotence in the face of that cruelty. And I think that every one of us who was on those boats, and it was a very challenging mission, we can get into kind of what made it so, triumphed over some of those challenges because of that representational obligation. We were each seeking to activate, to represent, and to be good citizens of the respective communities that we're from. So that was a kind of a lot of the motivation for why each of us were there. And then for me, I felt so personally inspired. At first, I was there just to support the mission, you know, get everything ready. I have a lot of close connections and I've worked a lot in Spain. And so I came to Barcelona to help see the boats off. But ultimately, when I met the people who were part of this mission, grandmothers and grandfathers, retirees, nurses, doctors, lawyers, journalists, people who were not just united by a common concern for the people of Palestine, but by a common recognition that what they have suffered, the people of Palestine, not just in Gaza, but across the occupied territories, could be nothing more or nothing less than a premonition for other parts of the world. That was at stake in this mission was not just the provision of humanitarian aid, although that was our narrow mission, but was a defense of international law, full stop. And in that sense, we felt that the crises that we're facing in the respective communities we came from, you know, as a Californian, for example, are so deeply connected to the erosion of those international norms and institutions and values that we have seen over the course of this genocide, that the sort of Pete Hegseth School of International Law that we see now on display and how the Trump administration domestically or internationally is disappearing people and, along with them disappearing their rights to due process, is killing, you know, innocent fishermen on the Caribbean coasts of Colombia and Venezuela. This interpretation of the rule of law, that it's might makes right, it's a thuggish and mobster idea, sort of do what you can get away with. I think it's really important to start making those connections. And many people who were there felt they were trying to draw a connection between domestic crises of democracy and a humanitarian crisis that was taking place in Gaza. And over the course of the mission, we endured just an escalating barrage of attacks, each of which were shocking in their own right, and all of which we had to try to sort of denormalize for much of the international community. You know, when we were sitting in the port of Sidi Bou Said in Tunisia, Benjamin Netanyahu personally authorized the deployment of a submarine to set a swarm of drones to attack our humanitarian vessels with our crews on board, of innocent civilians who were on board these vessels carrying lentils and rice and baby formula and basic medicine for hospitals that lacked it because of the blockade and the closed checkpoints on land. This is not just an attack on a humanitarian mission. It was also an attack on the sovereign nation of Tunisia, stationed as we were just a kilometer away from the presidential palace. Now, why is this so important? It's so important because if any other country were to do this, we would be shocked, you know, that the flagrant and premeditated attack on ordinary humanitarian workers sailing on the high seas, hundreds of nautical miles away from their destination, to be brutalized, attacked, menaced, you know, in life and in property. I mean, this is an act of kind of piracy. But for the state of Israel, acting so rogue, it's become just another Tuesday. You know, the same day that we were bombed in the port of Tunis, the state of Israel was bombing Syria, it was bombing southern Lebanon, and very famously, it was bombing Doha in Qatar, where they were trying to take out Hamas representatives who were supposedly part of a U.S. orchestrated peace negotiation. And so I think it feels and felt then very important to try to denude, try to strip away some of the levels of normalization of this kinds of violence. And I think that that was a part of how we reacted similarly to the threats that were being leveled against us in a wave of propaganda that tried to defame us as somehow a Hamas flotilla. Now, for me, there was something absurd about this, not just because of who I am, you know, someone bar mitzvah in Encino, you know, who went to a good school and comes from a nice Jewish family, you know, as being, you know, slandered as anti-Semites who were determined to destroy the state of Israel as opposed to provide aid for starving people. But just looking around the boat, I mean, there's Santi, the retired meteorologist from Menorca with three beautiful grandchildren that he keeps pictures of in his back pocket. There's Ada Colau, the mayor of Barcelona for 8 years, who's left two young children behind to set sail. You know, there are these people that I'm on these boats with that are clearly motivated by this sense of government failure and therefore citizen obligation, who are now having their lives menaced by a clear attempt by the state of Israel to set the stage for a very violent, as you say, illegal interception at sea. And I think that this was a process that we had to beat back those layers, those levels of normalization of that violence or the propaganda, you know, to get all the way to the siege itself. Even on the night of interception, many people were saying in the United States, well, what did the flotilla expect? They sailed into the so-called red zone, you know, as if it were a kind of Napoleonic confrontation of master commander at sea. But this was not just an asymmetry in terms of, you know, violent interception by naval forces at sea and humanitarians in humble motor cruisers and simple fishing vessels. This was also totally illegal by any definition of international law. There is no law that grants Israel the right to not just patrol, but violently seize property in international waters. We weren't even close to Palestinian waters. We were significantly far away from Palestinian waters in international waters. And again, we have to ask ourselves the question. Every day we read about a new crime against humanity that's committed with our tax dollars, or in the case of the Jewish community from which I come, committed in our name or with our symbols or with a justification for our safety. I think it's very important that we begin to push all the way back, step by step and layer by layer, to ask, if another country were to do this, you know, how would we react? And I think that is really what was at stake in this mission. It was our lives narrowly. And I can tell you, we were very concerned for our lives. Me less so than, for example, the mothers and fathers who were supporting families and who'd taken the courageous decision to leave behind work and livelihood and family responsibilities to be part of this humanitarian mission. But also concerned about, you know, what happens when a humanitarian mission like ours, as ultimately did end up happening, is abducted and disappeared and denied its fundamental rights to food, to water, to medicine, in the eyes of the international community. So those are the kind of stakes, I think, for this mission in general, and ones that we hope to be able to talk about on return from Israeli detention to alert the world to what is really going on.
As you are eloquently doing right now, former kids from the San Fernando Valley are very well represented in this conversation. You're listening to Middle East in Focus on listener-supported KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Esti Chandler, very grateful to be joined today by David Adler, political economist from Los Angeles, California. David currently serves as the co-general coordinator of Progressive International. He's with us today discussing his experience participating in the global Samud flotilla. David, as you were saying, you know, being Jewish and doing this work has a particular aspect to it. And like you, there were some other Jewish people participating in the flotilla, and as well as people from every walk of life. I wonder, how did Israeli authorities deal with people differently in relationship to their religion, race, nationality, or other characteristics of identity?
When we were abducted at sea, we were taken to the port of Ashdod, where the treatment for terror, we were taken, I suppose you could say, as prisoners of war, and therefore everything happened in this extrajudicial gray area to the members of the flotilla. So, you know, none of the rights we wanted to be afforded, deserved to be afforded, we might expect to be afforded, speaking with our lawyers, communicating with our governments, talking to our families. No, these were off the table. We were, you know, forced into positions of submission, beaten and abused, and systematically deprived of those basic rights as far as, you know, life-saving medicines, which were chucked into the trash in front of our face. And when we petitioned against that to say, that's my insulin, or those are my SSRIs, they said, oh, you should have thought of that before you came to Israel. To which we, of course, responded, we didn't come to Israel. We were sailing to Gaza, and you abducted and kidnapped us and brought us here. So there was a bit of a tension there, obviously written into the kind of treatment that we were receiving as terrorists. But in that port of Ashdod, it became clear that there were different types of categories, you might say, of prisoners or internees, I should call us, because we weren't charged with a crime. So it's, I wouldn't say that we were prisoners. One group of people that was obviously very high priority for the state of Israel were Palestinians themselves. So those members of the flotilla who were sailing either as dual nationals or as Palestinians were unbelievably courageous because they knew the risks that they were taking in terms of confronting the state of Israel in this way, being Palestinian, having that heritage in the context of a campaign that seeks to both deny them of their historical existence, or if they admit that, seek to sort of destroy it. And in that sense, a second group that was really targeted, and when I say targeted, I mean, you know, pursued, shackled, beaten, left into cells of solitary confinement, were Muslims and North Africans. The state of Israel has made exceptional arrangements to prevent any kind of pan-Arab contact with the people of Palestine. It's very threatening, the idea that there could be Tunisians or Algerians, let alone Jordanians, who are establishing deeper forms of political community with the people of Palestine. So that's a long-standing effort to basically prevent this, which made the Samud flotilla so exciting and so historic, was partly because it was bringing all these people from the Arab world, denied of their rights to travel to Palestine, to forge those communities, to, you know, be part of an Arab community together with the people who don't control the access to their territories. But a third group, I would say, a particularly kind of twisted mentality applied to the treatment of the Jews who were traveling to Gaza. You know, in the community that I was raised in Los Angeles, there was a certain contiguity of U.S.-American identity with Jewish identity for those of us who were, you know, U.S.-American Jews or California Jews. The idea was, you know, we had one country and wasn't that great. Wave the U.S.-American flag whenever you want. But we were also had Israel as a birthright and as a homeland that would always accept us under conditions of our persecution. And when I went to Jewish summer camp in Simi Valley, we'd raise the U.S. flag, we'd raise the Israeli flag. This kind of sense of being doubly lucky, doubly privileged. And I think today, in the emergence of a generation, my generation of U.S.-American Jewry, that is rising up, I think, to say, not in our name, these crimes can't be committed without tax dollars, there's an equal reaction on the opposite side of that. The state of Israel is saying, well, then you're not our Jews. You're not part of this project. And we're going to treat you like animals. And that was the line that they gave to one of the other Jews who was on the flotilla, who really, really needed medicine, critical medicine, and was begging, crying out basically all day and every day of our detention for that medicine. And they said simply, we do not give medicine to animals. So when we got to Port of Ashdod, you know, we were meant to strip and sit zip-tied in front of a flag of the State of Israel as a kind of measure of our disloyalty, while Minister Ben-Gvir came and screamed into our faces about us being terrorists. And of course, that mistreatment, that targeting, and that abuse kind of carried on into Ketziot, the detention center, the Guantanamo Bay of Israel, one of the most infamous detention camps that Israel has in the Negev Desert, where we were held for those 5 days. Not a coincidence that we were held there. And then, you know, people who've since come out of the flotilla process have repeated these stories. You know, we're not even alone. There was another, I think, Jewish Angelino, Noah, who's a photographer on the conscience of a boat that followed our fleet, who's come out just reporting horrific conditions of torture and abuse in these camps. And I think there's a special kind of delight there. And I remember being taken in for interrogation in the course of our detention, shackled in front of some interrogator from Israeli intelligence who said, you know, why are you here? Were you bought? Were you paid for? Were you shipped here? Who sent you here? The idea that there were Jews, let alone Jews from the United States, who disagreed or who wanted to recover a different set of values, traditions, a different set of, you know, memories, historical memory of our heritage from the Jewish tradition, that we would be so keen to stand up against the State of Israel that supposedly, you know, represents or pretends to kind of usurp and pervert, I think, those traditions. This really was boggling to the mind of our captors when we were there. So that was a bit of my experience, I think, you know, inside those camps, blended as it was with our treatment from the U.S. government, which was, I would say, equally inhumane and equally concerning about what it means for U.S. citizenship as opposed to what it means for just Jewish identity in the world stage.
Another thing that you touched on, and I heard in a voice memo recorded following your release from Israeli detention, sent to, transcribed, and published with your permission at Jacobin, you paint a picture of what the, quote, institutionalized impunity with which the Israeli regime operates, end quote. Because of that impunity afforded to the Israeli regime by American mainstream media outlets, what are important facts to correct that are often reported by those mainstream corporate-owned media outlets about the way the Israeli military operates, the way Israeli officials behave, and how you were treated with them and the U.S. General Consul during your captivity and following your release?
So I both have specific observations and more general conclusions about what this means for our media and how we understand the conflict in Israel and Palestine. On the more specific aspect, you know, for us, this was an experience. And for the people of Palestine, this is their reality. 2,000 of them have come out of captivity in the course of this hostage exchange and told horrendous stories of their abuse for months or for years or even in some cases for decades. But 9,000 people remain captive just from Gaza alone. That's not including the occupied territories, who are there held as we were without access to a lawyer, without access to any legal process, without even being charged with any crime. And so I think, you know, what we're trying to do with these stories is make the case to the U.S. press that if you're scandalized by the experience of these U.S. Americans, whether it's me or whether it's these veterans of conscience, U.S. veterans who are part of our mission, who, you know, were equally abandoned by their governments and tortured by our primary ally in the Middle East, known as Israel, you know, if this can happen to us, then we need people to be more interested, to be more not just curious, but dogged in the investigation of the conditions under which Palestinians are being held. They're often referred to as prisoners still in our mainstream media. That is not an accurate description, and it's a very dangerous one because it implies a crime with which they've never been charged. They are hostages. These people were kidnapped and abducted. I mean, to be accurate about the description, because that helps us to lead to questions about the conditions under which they're living today. A more general observation is the flat-footedness with which corporate media understand these questions. Still, the State of Israel is playing EU-US corporate press kind of like a fiddle. What will happen, as we saw time and time again in the drone strikes against our flotilla or in the propaganda marshaled against us or in our treatment as terrorists and prisoners of war, is we would come out with something to say, we were just attacked by a swarm of drones. The State of Israel would come out and say, that never happened. And we would be played like a fiddle when CNN or New York Times, any of these corporate media outlets would come out and say, activists allege this happened. Israel denies it. We would get both sides while we were kind of putting our lives on the line. And I think that there's still not been a reckoning in our mainstream media about how that flat-footedness actually provides a lot of political cover for the progress of this genocide. That while you were fighting, while you were both sidesing, did a rocket target Al-Shifa Hospital. While the Israelis say it was a failed Hamas rocket and the people in Palestine say, we saw a plane, we were targeted by this bomb. While you were litigating this question, we've moved on and Israel is now targeting schools. I think it's really critical that we accept that at this stage of the political economic centrifuge, right, radicalizing centrifuge that Israel finds itself in, these people are systematically lying, deceiving, and abusing the built-in norm in U.S. American corporate press to treat both sides equally valid and to play the narrative this way. I think it's critical that we finally triumph over that hesitation. We've seen this slowly but surely stripping out the passive voice that once had Palestinians be killed as opposed to killed by Israeli enemy. But I think that there's still a lot of work to do in trying to set the record straight, speak with the right vocabulary, and get ahead of the deceit that slows down any kind of mechanisms of accountability that do and must pass through our press.
David, you also commented that looking into the conditions at that camp and the treatment of those sent there is critical, as well as who is held there and why they were sent there, as the abusive treatment of people there endures. We have only a minute left, but people have asked me this question, and I promise to ask it of you. What happens when humanitarian activists are dropped off unkempt in detention camp garments at an airport in Jordan without phones, wallets, money, credit cards, or passports?
I think it's very critical to contextualize our treatment in terms of the broader flotilla, where we saw so many other countries, whether it was Brazil or Mexico, whether it was Colombia, Japan, or Australia, treat these prisoners coming out of a detention camp, torture camp, really, with such love and admiration, with at least a degree of humanity and support. And the U.S. government simply said to us, you know, not only we're not your babysitters, and not only are you on your own, but who even knows what kind of security we can afford you on your way back to the United States. You may well be detained, and if your immigration status is fragile, you may be deported as well. So I think that the conclusion that I have in making that connection between the suffering of the Palestinian people and the repression that's now advancing domestic in the Trump administration is that this is a sort of a shared paradigm of the ways in which citizenships are divided. There are good Jews and there are bad Jews. There are good U.S. Americans and there are bad U.S. Americans. And nothing is safe in a world that is dominated by these thuggish mobsters who have an idea of the rule of law that's highly interpretive and beneficial to their political project. I think that if we don't bring these causes together, bring these troubles together, consider them to be of a piece, dovetailing in our solidarity with Palestine, our solidarity with migrants, for example, in the streets of Los Angeles, menaced as they are by ICE, I think until we are able to make those connections, then we're going to keep losing ground to this reactionary international of the parties and unions and foundations and financiers that are succeeding to an advance a far-right agenda of exclusion, exploitation, and extraction across the world.
And as you guys were being attacked in the Mediterranean by the Israelis, armed by our government was attacking people on boats off the coast of Venezuela. David, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to be with us, for your lifelong support of KPFK, and for your bravery, because it really was bravery, to represent Southern California, Californians, Angelenos on that flotilla. From the Global Samud Flotilla October 4th press release, the Global Samud Flotilla carrying humanitarian aid for the Palestinian people in Gaza was illegally intercepted by the Israeli Navy in international waters over the course of 38 hours from the evening of October 1st through the morning of the 3rd. 462 peaceful activists from around 45 countries were on board the intercepted vessels. They were kidnapped and brought to Israel against their will, along with their ships, which were unlawfully seized and brought to Israel. The Israeli response has resulted and continues to result in a series of illegal and violent acts that constitute serious violations of international maritime, humanitarian, and human rights laws. The list of crimes committed by Israel is long, worth reading, and is available on the October 4th press release on the Global Samud Flotilla website at globalsamudflotilla.org. Once again, I want to thank our guest, David Adler, co-general coordinator of Progressive International and participant in the Global Samud Flotilla. I also want to thank our mutual friend Adam for connecting us and thank Mark Maxwell for his production support today. Our theme song is The Overture from Summer Night's Dream by Marcel Felipe. For KPFK Los Angeles, I'm Esti Chandler, thanking you for your continued support of KPFK and for taking this time to put the Middle East in focus.